Sirocco by Andrew Wood and Alastair Morton, Disc 3. Satisfied that she was unobserved, Sabina lifted the lid of the inner box and then opened her briefcase. Carefully and with precision, she took out 6 pounds of Semtex plastique and placed it in the inner box. The odorless plastic explosive was tiny in size, but it was considerably more powerful than TNT and was virtually invisible to conventional security devices, which had meant that it had gone undetected when her bag was X-rayed as she walked through the metal detector on the floor above. A mere 3 pounds would be enough to raise a 2-story building. The Czech-made plastic explosive had been manufactured since the height of the Cold War and had been linked to terrorist groups since it replaced dynamite in the early 1980s. Czechoslovakia had been one of the world's chief arms exporters during that time, selling hundreds of tanks, thousands of firearms, and large quantities of Semtex to Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Cambodia. And the pliable and undetectable explosive had become the weapon of choice for terrorists worldwide. Sabina fixed the detonation cap and taped the explosive securely to the bottom of the box. Glancing quickly at her watch, she primed the timer to go off in 43 hours' time, at precisely 11 o'clock on Wednesday morning. With the bomb now live and securely in place, she closed the inner box and picked it up gently. Opening the door and carrying her briefcase in her left hand, she walked out confidently into the deposit box store, placed the inner box containing the bomb back into her safety deposit box.
"Will that be all, miss?" the attendant asked Jane Beckett as she locked it securely in place, pushing the box into position and turning the key firmly. He was unaware of the explosive power that sat no more than a foot away from him.
"Yes, thank you," Jane Beckett replied. "Have a good one."
The attendant then led her to the exit of the safety deposit box area, and she made her way out of the bank. The bomb was now in place, and there was no turning back, and she was happy that she had successfully started phase 2 of Sirocco without a hitch. As she considered her actions, she thought of home. She thought of Geneva as a child with her mother, and she thought of the summers when her father would come and stay with them, when her safe European home seemed to be the whole world. But above all, she thought of when she was happy. And then she thought of Suleiman. Chapter 11. Now that Jack knew, or at least suspected, that the known Iraqi terrorist Colonel Suleiman was involved in the bombing of North Station in Boston, he had something to work with, and he wasted no time in putting his plan into action. It was too much of a coincidence to Jack for Suleiman to have resurfaced at this time, and his years of experience told him that the formerly dead Iraqi war criminal was involved with the attack. Jack sat in his office, surrounded by files which now covered his entire desk and which threatened to overflow onto the well-worn carpet. Cups of half-drunk coffee sat cold at various points across the desk and the windowsill, and the ashtray was overflowing with cigarette butts. Reading through one of the old files on Suleiman, Jack picked up the pack of Camels from the desk and lit one.
"I thought you'd quit that years ago." Roy was standing in the doorway.
"I did, but you know me, Roy. I've never been a quitter."
"Well, that's certainly true. So, what's this big news of yours, then?"
"Well," Jack took a deep drag on the cigarette and exhaled, blowing a plume of blue smoke into the room. "Guess who came back from the dead today?"
Right, yeah, I know, Jack. Elvis Presley lives in New Mexico now, right? Working on a new album?" "You got me all the way down here for this?"
"No. Try Colonel Haji Hassan Suleiman."
Jack sat back in his chair and let the words roll slowly off his tongue, knowing that Roy would be as shocked at hearing them as he was when he first heard.
"Holy shit, Jack. You're bullshitting me, right?"
Roy stepped into the room properly and closed the door behind him.
"You gotta be fucking kidding me. Where?"
It's no joke, buddy. I wish to hell that it was. Alan Korb made him today in Geneva, of all places.
Geneva?
Roy was astounded at hearing that the fearsome terrorist was not dead, but was alive and kicking, but was more astounded at where he had been seen. He had half expected him to have been caught on camera in some desert town somewhere in the Middle East, caught by accident by someone with a camera who just happened to be in the right place at the right time, but at least making some attempt to keep a low profile and stay out of sight. But in Geneva, he was about as far from Baghdad as you could get.
Yeah, Alan saw him in a cafe in the city talking to some local businessman. I don't know about you, Roy, but somehow bad news like this makes me feel a whole lot better.
Yeah.
Roy sat down in the chair opposite Jack and helped himself to one of Jack's camels and lit it.
Look, now you've got me smoking again. Well, I thought he was assassinated in Baghdad.
It's a bit of a thing to get your head around, you know. Roy took several heavy puffs on the cigarette.
And for him to keep hidden for all this time.
Yeah, I know, Roy. But at least we know for damn sure who's behind the bombing in Boston. It's not Bin Laden or Al-Qaeda or anyone else. Don't ask me how I know. It's Suleiman. I can feel it in my goddamn bones.
Did Alan get a fix on him?
Asked Roy.
No, he didn't. But he did on the guy he was with. I'm going to give Werner Schmidt a call in Geneva. But I wanted you in on this first, okay?
Roy was relieved that Jack had included him with this information and knew that only a select few at this stage would be aware of Suleiman's return. If the information leaked to the press, he knew they'd go crazy with it. A presumed dead Iraqi war criminal wreaking a devastating attack on the U.S. would give the media a field day and would serve as more ammunition for the anti-war movement.
Of course, Jack.
Roy took one last puff on the cigarette and stubbed it out in the ashtray.
If Suleiman is in Switzerland, you can bet that he won't be alone. So what is he doing there?
I don't know, Roy. But he's a long way from home, and this could be dangerous for him. That's why I think we got to get Swiss intelligence in on it. I'm going to call Schmidt in Geneva. They might know something that they aren't telling us. But my bet is they don't even know who's walking around in their own backyard.
Jack stood up and walked to the window behind him. As he stared out into the bleak early evening, Roy flicked through the numerous files on Suleiman that lay mounted upon the desk. Roy had always been the rational counterpoint to Jack's bulldozing approach, the measured voice that often played devil's advocate to Jack's act-first-ask-later attitude. In full knowledge of their different styles of work, they were respectful of each other and aware that neither of them could work as well as they did without the input of the other. Outside, the wind had begun to blow, and rain began to lacerate against the glass pane, as if the weather itself was turning against them. The trees swung as the wind blew ferociously through their tired branches, and the sky filled with a swirl of heavy cloud that threatened to cast the backwaters of Virginia into an early dark, foregrounding the horrors that were to come.
But if he's still there, Jack added, I'll tell you right now that I'm going to get the son of a bitch. You can make book on it.
Half laughing, Roy replied,
What about Schmidt? I don't think he'd go for that too much. You remember what he's like. What was it you used to say? There's too much damn European in the man?
Yeah, but that was a long time ago, Jack said, still staring out the window, his back to Roy. And anyway, he owes me a favor now. I'm going to fly in tonight to Germany to meet him, and I want you to stay here. I need a man back here who I can trust not to screw it up and to keep this from leaking out. You of all people know what would happen if the press even got a whiff of this.
Oh, sure thing, Jack. But for everyone's sake, I hope you're right about Suleiman. If you go off to Germany and Geneva after what happened in Boston and things don't pan out, there's going to be a real shitstorm here. And if things do go billy up and you're not around, your ass could take a serious downturn.
Jack chuckled to himself. Self-preservation and career-mindedness had never featured in his way of thinking. He liked to think of himself as deeply old-fashioned in that respect, and all the better for it. And moreover, Roy knew that. "That's not any concern of mine. Suleiman's involved in this, and we need to bring him in. Anyway," and he turned around to face Roy, who was lighting up another cigarette, "I've been up and down more times than a hooker's G-string." "Well, I hope you're right, Jack. Listen, I've got a meeting with the President and Governor Russell in an hour, but notify me when you get to Germany, okay? I'll have the company jet ready for you, and don't worry, I won't say anything until I've heard from you. But be careful, Jack." Jack laughed as Roy stood up to leave the room. "Careful? You know me better than that by now." Roy smiled as he left the room, knowing full well that Jack would do things on his own terms anyway. It was how he operated, how he always had, and he was all the better for it. Careful? It wasn't even in his vocabulary. As Roy left the room, the door swinging closed behind him, sending papers flapping about in the draft, Jack picked up the phone and dialed Werner Schmidt's number in Geneva. Werner was someone Jack had encountered during his military days. A Swiss native, he was much older than Jack, about 20 years, but looked good for his age. He was the head of the Swiss intelligence service and had worked in Eastern Europe during the Cold War. Similar to Jack, he was old-fashioned in his approach and stuck steadfast to his morals, a practice in no small part attributed to his upbringing. The eldest of three sons, his Jewish father helped hide Holocaust refugees during the Second World War, and this dark period from human history left a deep impression on the young boy, the horrors he bore witness to as a child greatly shaping his adult life. He had worked with Jack when the young American was stationed in the former Czechoslovakia in the 70s and had encountered him during a special forces operation in eastern Germany. After the 70s, Jack's work took him out of Europe for the most part, but the two touched base from time to time, sharing vital information and forming a strong bond between two nations that had, at least in recent history, struggled to find and maintain any close links. "Hi, Werner. It's Jack Wildey." "Jack?" Werner was caught off guard for a moment. A call from American intelligence wasn't what he'd been expecting on a Monday afternoon. "Yeah, Jack Wildey at Langley. I'm sure you haven't forgotten about us just yet, have you, Werner?"
"Try as I might, no, I haven't."
"How are you doing there?" asked Werner.
"Not so good, I'm afraid," Jack replied solemnly.
"I thought so. A call from Wildey rarely bodes well, from my experience."
Werner always used people's surnames, a formality that had always seemed odd to Jack, given that their friendship went back many years. But it was an idiosyncrasy he respected. Werner did everything that way. He was reliable, but above all, he was professional to the end, and this was a trait that Jack could only too readily relate to.
"I hope you aren't going to spoil my day, Wildey, but I have a distinct feeling that that's what you are about to do."
"Unfortunately, yes. We've got big trouble here, and I need to see you."
"Okay." Werner paused as if considering his words very carefully. "Would I be far off in assuming this is to do with the incident in Boston?"
"You're spot on, Werner. Or at least we think it could be. I can't talk to you over the phone. I need to see you in person. It's real important."
"Well, I'm always glad to help. You know that, Wildey."
"Sure. I'm flying out to Ramstein tonight, but I need you to do something for me first. I need you to run a make on a Thomas Ruse. He lives in Geneva, at least as far as we know. He works for a company there, TMI, Talib Medical Instruments."
"Thomas Ruse? Talib Medical Instruments?"
Werner went quiet again, assimilating the information Jack had just divulged.
"Okay, Wildey, no problem. But tell me you don't have some covert operation going on in my backyard without telling me first, do you?"
"Werner, I give you my word that I don't, but this is serious.
We're gonna have to work together on this.
Werner laughed to himself.
Together? When have you ever worked together with anyone, Wilde?
Jack attempted to reassure Schmidt, but the Swiss expert was miles ahead of him.
I'll look into what you have asked me, but I need to be in on whatever it is you have going on here, Wilde. Things are different these days, and you can't go stomping around in other people's pools, no matter how big a fish you are.
Jack gave his word, and Werner accepted, knowing that Jack was liable to do things his way no matter, but knew that he would never go against his word. For men of their generation, their word was who they were.
Can you meet me tomorrow at Ramstein Air Base? I'll be there at 0900 hours. It's that important, Werner.
Of course, Wilde. I'll be there.
His polite and pleasant disposition and his mid-European accent disguised his intentions, although Jack had long since become wise to this.
I just hope this is as important as you say it is.
I really wish it wasn't, Werner, but you have my assurances that it is. I'll see you at 9 tomorrow, then.
Okay, Wilde.
I'll arrange it with the base security. They'll be expecting you. I'll meet you in the officers' club.
Werner had always been somewhat of a mentor for Jack. He'd helped him when he was younger, and in many ways Jack was another version of the Swiss, although their opinions often differed.
How's Louise these days, Wilde? Are you still stringing her along?
Yeah, she's good, thanks.
Is she still keeping up with the art?
Yeah, she's teaching now, too, at the university.
That's good, Jack,
Werner said, his colloquialism catching the weathered American by surprise.
It's good for a man to have a creative outlet.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
It's not good if a man goes through life without an appreciation of the finer things. It's good to be a little more cultured, Wilde. Makes a man more rounded.
Schmidt had always tried to instill a little of his own in Jack, although not always with any great success. But they'd remained friends through the years. Jack humored Werner as he waxed lyrical for a few minutes. His cultural appreciation, as he termed it, was one of his passions, and he would talk at great length to anyone who had the misfortune to be within earshot. It was an endearing side to Werner, although not one which Jack in any way shared. But he let his old friend talk for a few moments before he made his excuses and hung up. Setting the phone down, Jack leaned back in his chair. His shirt was creased and unironed and looked as if it had been worn for several days. Knowing Jack, it probably had. He sparked up another Camel, shaking the ash from his cuff and sweeping it off the desk onto the floor. Outside, night was closing in, and he had a long journey to make. He called Roy, who had left for his meeting with the President and Governor Russell, but he'd left the arrangements for Jack's flight. Picking up his coat, he turned the light off and left his office, stopping only to shove a handful of files into his case and another wad under his arm. A few moments later, he was on his way to the airport, stopping briefly to call Louise before boarding a plane straight for Germany, just before midnight. The car pulled up on the apron next to the aircraft. He pulled his jacket up tight around his neck, and he ran up the steps to board the plane as the rain beat down heavily in the moonless night. 20 minutes later, they were airborne. After several hours had passed, and as the plane substituted the dark Atlantic for the first signs of mainland Europe, and as the sun began to rise over the clear skies on the horizon, a cab stopped outside of 150 West Flagler Street in the center of the city of Miami. Out of the car stepped Sabina, dressed again in black with her white blouse and her blonde wig in place, and paying the driver with a crisp $20 bill, she strode casually into a Miami branch of the Bank of America.